So on to item five, presentation from Brown Armstrong on the audit for fiscal year 17.
Jerry. Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I need money too, look.
It was my last one.
Yeah, I didn't want to speak to that, but that's tawdry.
So you guys are in competition for the wines that we're doing.
Good morning.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Are you going to lead us in this item, Henry?
You bet. I'm excited to bring to you Andy Paulden and Brooke Baird, audit supervisor and partner of Brown Armstrong. They've been our auditors for, I think, 14 years. We just concluded the CAFR, and that's one of the documents that they're going to present for you, including some other additional reports to the board regarding internal control, how the audit process went, allow any questions from trustees. So with that, I'll let Andy and Brooke.
Thank you, Henry. Again, my name is Andy Paulden, a partner with Brown Armstrong, and Brooke is here as the audit manager. We're the key team members, if you will, that are responsible for all of the accounting and auditing services provided to your association. And it is our pleasure to be here today to present to you the results of our audit of your December 31, 2017 financial statements. I'm a returning member, if you will, of your audit team. We've had this engagement for a number of years, and as best practices dictate, as required by your board, we have a rotational process of bringing on new eyes, if you will. So Rosalba Flores was the partner before me, or after me, because I served in a number of years of that capacity. And so it's really great to be back here. I've always enjoyed working with this organization. You have great people here, a tremendous board, and you guys really take the financial reporting process very seriously. So we truly appreciate that. So we've got our outline, our agenda, if you will, that is in front of you today, and we'll try to be as brief as possible on that. I know you have a very full agenda, but we certainly want to be thorough. We'll go through the purpose of the audit, briefly talk about the process, what it is we do and why, some of the main areas that we emphasize in our engagement, and then most importantly, talk about our deliverables, if you will, the reports that we've issued as a result of our engagement. And we've broken that up between Brooke and myself. So I'll get started with the purpose of an audit. Just to remind everybody, as you know, each year your association prepares a CAFR, or Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, whereby you are representing and asserting that all of the financial information that's contained therein is fairly presented in accordance with GAAP, or Generally Accepted Accounting Principles. It's our responsibility as an independent organization to conduct an audit in accordance with our professional standards and render a written opinion as to whether or not your assertions and representations are in fact accurate. That written opinion accompanies your financial statements and gives the reader or users of that information contained in your CAFR kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval that somebody outside your organization has reviewed it and takes responsibility for its fair presentation as well. So with that understanding, I'm going to turn it over to Brooke to go through the audit process, talk about the audit areas that we emphasize, and then she'll turn it back over to me, and I'll go through our deliverables, if you will, our products as a result of our
deliverables. Quick question for the Henry. Is this the same as what's in our packet?
It is.
Okay.
It is. Mm-hmm. Just a formal cover.
Okay, so for the audit process, it always starts out with our timeline coordination between ourselves and then Sisera management and staff. We do this by laying out what we call the critical dates list. I did go over this during our entrance, but it lays out any of the pertinent activities that have to happen from beginning to end. So it takes us through planning, the AC entrance, through interim final field work, all the way through our review procedures up into issuance. Typically, the big dates that we like to look at are our field work dates. We usually spend 2 weeks here on site. We spend multiple weeks prior to that planning, many weeks in wrap-up and drafting stage. And then before we come out for final field work, we spend about a week analyzing your investments and getting those sections set up. The critical dates list allows us to hold each other responsible. It's a living, breathing document, meaning dates change, things come up, but we try to stick to it as much as possible, and it allows us, if we do receive delays in a certain area, where we could adjust the future dates going out. So it consistently keeps moving forward and allows both parties to know what's to be expected. During our planning procedures, we always start to gain our understanding of internal controls. We review our prior documentation. We reach out to management and other members of staff at CICERA, ask about any new policies and procedures in place, any risks that they're aware of that have popped up since the last year's audit. We also do online research of Contra Costa just to make sure that we're aware of anything that's been in the news, anything that's been published. We review your minutes since our last field work. We also go in and re-review board minutes from the prior couple of years just to remind ourselves what's going on. And we always look through your note disclosures of your prior CAFR. Once we're on site, we do go through, we meet with members of management and staff that perform the day-to-day functions. We call it our documentation of significant transaction classes. We perform walkthroughs of these. We pick transactions to follow through to make sure that we understand your procedures. This is very important because when we come out here to test certain transactions, we want to make sure that we have a good understanding of what the attributes of the procedures that we'll be testing are. Confirmations with independent third parties. When applicable and available, we always try to confirm with reliable independent third parties. The most important ones that we probably receive are with your actuary, investment managers, and then the employers that are with your plan. We prepare these during planning stage, and we analyze these during our field work. And then during interim, we're out here in March. We bring a staff of about four people. Interim is with our documentation of internal controls. That's our kickoff when we start really getting going with audit. And we're also testing a lot of your participant data. So we do both tests on active and retired members. We recalculate current year contributions. We recalculate a period of benefit payments for a sample of participants. We also look into your current year deceased members and current year terminations. And then we also send employer confirmations to confirm with them pensionable payroll salary to make sure that the two what you have in your system is correct in comparison to what the employers have. During this time, we also do our SAS 99. That's our fraud. We are required by the standard to look into any areas that people consider more risky as it relates to fraud. We have a meeting every 6 months at Brown Armstrong called our retirement kickoff meeting. We go over areas that we consider risky. We look into any areas that we consider that are new that are risky. And then when we come out here, we also interview a board member, maybe one or two management and non-management members. Then final field work, this is where we're looking at your financial statement line items. We're looking to make sure that every line item has support that's material. We're using client reconciliations, we're doing analytics, and we're tying up all our confirmations to your GL. And that happens in late April. It was the week of April 30th this year. And then 2F is report preparation. So once we leave the field, Henry's already began drafting the CAFR. We're working on our reports, our reportables to the board that Andy will go over shortly. We're tying up any loose ends, any sections that are still open. Both Andy and myself are going through the review process. And then once we've cleared, when we feel we've met our audit requirements, we give it to another partner at the firm. We call them our cold reviewers. It's a quality control review partner, and they go through the engagement also to make sure that we haven't missed anything. It's like a set of fresh eyes. Does anyone have any questions on any of that?
Brooke, would you talk a little bit more about what you would expect to learn interviewing one or more board members?
Board members?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So we ask questions regarding any of their knowledge of suspected fraud, any areas of weakness, any concerns or internal controls that they're aware of. We ask about any areas of the business that they think are more risky, if there's any areas they'd like us to look into in addition to our normal testing. And then what we would do with those responses is if we do not have an audit procedure that already addresses those concerns, we create an audit procedure. It's approved by the partner, and then we go forth with it to make sure that we're addressing everyone's concerns. It would be the same as when we when we interview the management and staff also, if there's any red flags they want us to look into.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the follow-up to John's question, which was if it sounds like the interviews of board members are aimed at or geared to trying to identify concerns or problems that might not be evident, but that one or more board members might feel is, you know, some kind of an issue. So you also do the same with management and staff?
Yeah, because we found at various levels of the organization, people have a different view of what they do and a different view of what's important. And some people maybe on the ground level, while the board might have a fairly overview of the organization, sometimes if you're dealing in benefits, you're down with the nitty-gritty, so you might think of certain things that could be a red flag in just benefits or just, you know,
right.
Dealing in the finance department. So it just allows us to get more of a honed-in approach because everyone has a different, you know.
How did you select who you're going to interview?
Uh-huh.
How did you select who you were going to interview?
We do it randomly.
You just draw them out of a hat. So I'm really thinking of management and staff. How do you decide that? You just literally randomly
We receive a listing of individuals that work at the organization, and we track it for the last 5 years to see who we interview. Very often we'll try to get someone at a higher level of finance, the CEO, things such of that nature on a consistent basis. But then we try to keep it various throughout the years. Or if someone did have a red flag in prior years, we try to follow up with them in a current year.
Out of curiosity, how many board members have been interviewed by Brown over the years? Raise your hand. Two? That's it?
Three.
Three?
Yeah.
Interesting random aspect of the process.
Well, if I could follow up on that, it's random with a little bit of bias, only from the standpoint that if we have a new person or someone that's been promoted within the management team, we may look at that. And then when we're talking to the board members, you know, a big part of our understanding and evaluation of your controls is the overall tone at the top, if you will. And it kind of starts with the board and moves into management. And so we kind of get an understanding from you, the board members and upper management, kind of what the tone at the top is, how important is internal controls for the organization. And then when we're evaluating or interviewing maybe lower members of your team, your management, we'll get that corroboration, if you will. You know, management's told us one thing. Is that really what is going on in the organization?
Yeah, I didn't get a sense, though, that there's a healthy cross-section of people who've been interviewed. Do you often do the same people?
The individual that we interviewed last year was a woman. She's no longer on the board, and she was on the AC.
Sounds like Deborah.
So that was her last year, not her.
Deborah Allen, right.
Yeah. So you guys could add that to your...
She went on to greener pastures with Parkway.
Yeah.
I think Mr. Gordon's suggesting he should be randomly selected.
Yeah.
No, I was just trying to get a sense of,
you
know,
next year.
No, I don't want to be interviewed. I guess I'm trying to understand, you know, it's the old, the output is only as good as the input. So if you're talking to the same people all the time, I don't know what you're going to learn that's new.
Yeah, I'd have to look at our rotation. I know the last 4 years, I think we've done different individuals. I did rejoin the engagement just like Andy. Last year, I took a break for about 3 to 4 years. But I could look into that and make sure that next year during the planning.
It's just, I was just doing it based
on
the response.
I'll recommend Mr. Gordon for next
thank
year.
Thank you.
I already have his name down.
And knowing what our process is.
Is there a second?
Is there a second? Over and over, because then we're called into question. Well, you just keep interviewing the easiest one. Type of situation. That's certainly not what
occurs. But it sounds like it's an invite, so that's
no,
that we not an invite because we're going to mark it down. But
just trying.
No, but I just want to comment that we're also
Henry's got it.
Yeah, it also introduces. We're building up the role of the audit committee, and we're going to have a meeting afterwards. But the participation and the knowledge gained by the audit committee members and the team, and sharing it with the trustees, that's also important too. And it's a subcommittee of the trustees, so we can talk more in depth to certain issues regarding the audit, regarding operational activity, regarding, you know, policy, and so it'll gain knowledge into what's going on, Sister.
Okay, good.
All right. So moving on, number three is our significant audit areas and scope of audit work. We use a risk-based audit approach. Every year we look at the areas. We use both qualitative and quantitative factors. The majority of your time we're out here is spent on contributions, benefit payments, and investments. Those are the riskiest areas in almost all the areas. But as things come up during the audit, during our interviews, our walkthroughs, we adjust these. We do our risk assessment throughout the audit. A lot of times, even towards the end of wrap-up, things come up that, you know, strike our fancy or become more alarming than they did at the beginning. So it's something that we're constantly tracking throughout the audit and adjusting as necessary. Investments and related earnings. For this, we do confirmations. We send confirmations to 100% of your investment managers, and we tie out a sample of those and anything that looks alarming. So we do analyze 100% of the confirmations.
What's the threshold for alarming, just to give me a sense?
I guess alarming is the wrong word. It'd be more new, terminated, to make sure those transactions occur correctly. If you have investment managers, let's say, that don't respond and they're, you know, $2 million, we don't go look those down. What we'll do is we'll get records from the management and we'll reconcile their records up to that. We do look at the balances. We do variance analysis. We do analytics. We want to make sure that we're analyzing every line item completely and accurately, and we look up any red flags as necessary. Henry can attest to anything that looks we look at classification of investments. We have a lot of questions about those a lot out here, just to make sure everything's on its right line item, especially with GASB 72 implementation a couple years back. It's just really important to make sure your classifications are correct. We also tie out the income and expenses. These confirmations contain that information. And then participant data.
Excuse me, on that, we also follow up and work with our investment team to gain information to make sure we're recording the categories of the investments in accordance with what's been presented routinely in front of the board. You know, the classifications of certain equities, fixed income, limited partnerships, so on and so forth. And so they're the same questions we get, and we touch base with Tim and his group to make sure they get reported consistently with what we're reporting on the investment earnings.
Henry, what's an example where you would have trouble determining what category it fits in?
A brand new investment manager that we just brought on board, what types of categories, what are they doing for us? We have to set up GL accounts for them. We may not get the information from the investment manager timely, and so the custodian, there might be timing differences with State Street if they're custodian of the investment. But there's workarounds. We sit down with Tim and Jeff or Chi-Chi because they've got contacts with the investment manager. They know what they're doing. So it's just a matter of recording the information accurately on the financial statements. Probably one of the biggest issues we have is the timeliness of data, making sure the investment managers, because December 31st, a lot of the investment managers, if not all, they're also closing down their books. So there's delays there in trying to get the final statements, and adds a little bit of time, but we hustle in trying to get the information and trying to pin it down so the auditors can confirm balances. There might be transactions that occur on that last statement, market appreciations, gain or losses there. So we're busy trying to get all that data.
Where it's not public, the private equity alternative investments, I think. Do you spend more time on valuation as contrasted to where there's a public security and that public valuation is well established?
We do in the sense of obtaining the statement because we want to rely on an outside document that says it. We're not going to make our own conclusions as to market value. There are occasions where an investment manager just simply is not able to get a year-end statements, and we've estimated, we've used the September 30th, the preceding quarter, and roll forward any additional cash infusions or distributions back, and that can be audited, and we'll roll it that way, but that's very few and rare between. I don't think we had to do very much of that, if
and,
not
and
all.
If I can answer Mr. Phillips' question, you have a very good question. So Brooke talked about audit risk, and you know, audit risk is where there's a possibility or probability that there could be a financial misstatement for whatever reason within your financial reporting process. And so within your investment strata, we have a risk analysis within that strata as well. Obviously, you know, the fixed incomes and the, you know, the stock equities, those are pretty easy to verify because there's openly traded on the market. And then when you have the private equity and the real estate, those are a little more difficult to value. So when we put those in the hierarchy, certainly private equity and real estate kind of rise to the higher level of risk in that area. So proportionately in regards to auditing the investments, I would have to say affirmatively that there's probably a little bit more time spent on the private equity arena just because of the nature of that investment, how it's held, how it's managed, those kind of things. So yes is the answer to your question. We do spend more time in that area. And then back to your question on the alarming, as auditors, we have a certain amount of paranoia built into our profession anyway. But what's unique about, the 37 Act and retirement systems in general, typically you have a pretty good triangle, if you will, of controls and checks and balances. You've got your custodian, you've got you as a client, you've got the investment managers. And so what we're really looking for there is, okay, first of all, is the client recording appropriate information, typically using the custodian as the record keeper, the primary or top of the pyramid record keeper. But then you've got the investment managers that you want to corroborate what the client is reporting, you guys are reporting, what the custodian is reporting. And so we kind of make sure that we get confirmations, if you will, from those two parties and compare and contrast. And most of the differences are typically timing, maybe a little bit of a pricing issue. When we define alarming, it's really more materiality. Are there things that are just way out of whack in terms of dollar amounts and or classifications? And then we have to root around and find out why does that exist, and we certainly use your staff and your investment staff to find out the answers. Why are these things so different?
Yeah, so but on that, I think the key point that John was getting at is that when you have investments that are marked to market, stock, what have you, it's easily ascertainable. But if you have private equity investments, alternative investments, what is it you're looking at to establish the value of those? Because as I understand your charge, you're not evaluating internal controls. You're not actually auditing internal controls. You're auditing to a level to assure the public and us that our representation of financial condition and the statements that we issue is correct. Right. Have I got that right?
Right.
All right. So in order to do that, if our financial statements are going to reflect what the pension fund's value is across all ranges of investments, what's the rigor, what's the due diligence on private equity, on alternative investments? How do you ascertain value? Yeah,
that's a real good question, and the profession has gotten better on auditing that, because when they first came out, and that's been quite some time ago, what do we do type of a situation? And really our first charge is to look at the initial due diligence that's done on engaging a particular manager. What did you guys do in terms of your homework, kicking the tires, site visits, what have you, to ascertain that this is a reputable manager, they're going to do what you want them to do, and hopefully develop the returns and preserve your capital, if you will, going into it. So that's extremely important. And then your ongoing due diligence, whether it's your financial accounting staff, your investment staff, the investment managers, your custodian, your investment advisor, what are they doing in terms of making sure that that a particular organization is properly reporting information to you on a timely basis, and that it is in fact accurate. And then a big part of what we rely on is most, if not all, of these types of entities are audited by reputable firms, and that's one of the first things that we look at, because years ago, long, long time ago, there was a case back in New York that a private equity firm was issuing financial statements on the letterhead of a firm that never existed. So that's certainly one of the first things that we look at, and most of those firms, if not all of them, are using the Big Four type firms for a lot of reasons. Just for this reason, they want that good housekeeping seal of approval. Not that they're using any different standards than we use, but they have certainly a lot of resources to audit very big numbers, and so that's a big part of it. And then, what kind of responses are we getting to our confirmations when we ask for such things as insurance, or do you have any SOX reports about their internal controls? Are they open or are they closed? And when I first started auditing these types of investments, that arena was very closed. I had to sign non-disclosure agreements to be able to talk to these people to get some assurance about valuation, and they've backed off that quite a bit now, and they're much more open. But, you know, we just really want to make sure that you guys are doing a good job of monitoring him, because we're here once or twice a year. You guys are here all the time, and so is your staff. Are your investment advisors doing their job and monitoring them as well? And then are the managers getting appropriate financial reports? Are they clean? There's no disclaimers of opinion or adverse opinions. And are there internal controls in place? And those are those SOX reports that are referred to that give us some assurance. So those are the main things that we look at and emphasize when we look at private equity.
So it sounds like that in order for us to accept the value that they say it's worth, then you test all the credibility points around how that value could have been established, or red flags that would tell you that there's a concern, right?
Absolutely. Trust but verify.
Okay. I just want to get a sense of how you go about it.
All right. Three D is employee and employer contributions. At year end, we confirm with all the employers the amount of contributions they have on their records for their employee and their employer. During interim, we also test a sample of individual employee contributions to make sure that they're correct. Benefit payments, we do the same thing. We do not confirm with the employers, but we do a recalculation of a sample of retirees every year. And then we do analytics at year end to see if anything if anything's missing, if there's large variances, if there's unexplained differences, things such as that. This year we did, or you implemented GASB 82. This is an amendment to GASB 6768. It provides more clarification and language differences for employer payroll. It had an immaterial effect in your financial statements, but it did change some of the titles on the schedules in the RSI section. There is a note disclosure on this in note one, where it talks about the implementation of new accounting pronouncements.
So are you going into the current year agreed upon conditions and recommendations? Because it sounds like you just started with the with the first one, and I have a question.
Oh yeah, we're going through.
Yeah, we'll get to those. If it's the pleasure of the board, I can go through the audit opinions, and then that will be the final document that we'll refer to. It'll certainly be
all right
to answer any questions, or if we could jump to it right now, whatever the pleasure of the board is.
Go ahead.
Okay. I think we should jump to what's important. What do you think?
I'd suggest we stay on their schedule.
Let's do that.
And we kind of go to the good stuff, and then the maybe less than good stuff type of a situation. And I'll explain what I mean by that as I go through the presentation. But obviously our most important deliverable, in my opinion, is what I referred to at the outset of the presentation. That's our independent auditor's report on the financial statements. I'm going to date myself a little bit. And this is this document. It's a three-page document.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing this for about 33 years now. And when I first started, it was one page, three paragraphs. And the interest of simplicity, our profession is certainly tongue at. And you can certainly see that it's added a significant amount of information. But the intent there was to, kind of overcome the expectation gap about what an audit is and what it entails. And so that's a big part of what's included in this report. But the most important aspect is our opinion paragraph, whereby we do opine that your financial statements are fairly presented in accordance with GAAP. That is the highest opinion that an independent audit organization can render and issue, and as always, your organization should be congratulated on that. That opinion accompanies those financial statements, as I said, and gives the good housekeeping seal of approval, as I mentioned to you previously. And then I'll go into now the report to the Board of Retirement and the Audit Committee, and that's this green folder that's handed out today, and it is the same materials that were distributed in your reports, and there are three deliverables that are included in that document. The first is our Statement on Auditing Standards 114 report, and if I can put this in context, we never lose sight of the fact that we are engaged by this board, we work for this board, and we report to this board. Obviously, you discharge the day-to-day performance and the engagement, the audit engagement, and your competent staff, and we work with them hand-in-hand in the performance of the engagement. Nonetheless, we're required at the end of the engagement to provide you a written report as to whether or not there are any issues that arose, disagreements on an auditing or accounting matter, any adjustments that were made that were either booked or not booked throughout the audit process, whether or not there was any opinion shopping that occurred, if you will, you know, did you go out and look for a second opinion on any auditing issue or accounting issue that we brought forward? Or was there any arm twisting, for lack of a better term, in regards to us being retained and engaged as your auditors? And I'm pleased to say that's a very standard report, the report that we have issued, and there were no such items to report to you. So again, congratulations to you and your staff. I also talked about at the outset of the presentation that we have to follow professional standards. And not only do we have to follow our AICPA professional standards, but anytime we conduct a governmental type engagement, of which you are, we have to follow what are oftentimes referred to as the yellow book standards, because they're contained in the yellow book. But these are the government auditing standards. It deals with a lot of different things. It deals with our qualifications, training, CPE, documentation, review, all of those kind of things. But it also requires that we take a good look at your internal controls above and beyond what we typically do in an AICPA audit to see if there's anything that resulted or any weaknesses or deficiencies that resulted in any modifications to your financial statements, areas that you can improve upon and that have an impact on your financial statements. We're also required to look at your compliance with laws and regulations, non-compliance with would have or may have had a material impact on your financial statement. So, and we're required to render a report in that regard. So I'm pleased to report that there were no weaknesses in controls that meet those standards, nor were there any instances of non-compliance. So again, highest report that we can issue, and you're going to be congratulated. And then I want to, before we dive into the agreed upon conditions, I kind of want to put those in context. And there's a hierarchy of findings, if you will, and recommendations that we can make in our financial profession and in a financial statement audit engagement. And we can have significant deficiencies, we can have material weaknesses, and anything that kind of falls below that is kind of an agreed upon condition. And what we talk about in those agreed upon conditions are these are things that had no impact on your financial statements, had no impact on a report on your financial statements, but they're things that we see that can hopefully make you a better organization, whether it's through efficiency or just shore up a couple of things that we just see need improvement on in the financial reporting process. And so putting those in context, I'll go first to the prior year recommendations, and you can see there were several. We have to follow up on those each year. And I'm initially not going to go into them individually, and then we'll answer or address any individually if you so desire. But anyway, we follow up on those in the current year, do a look back, did what was promised and discussed when we issued those in the prior year, did that occur, and was appropriate corrective action taken? And in all instances, we believe that it has and or will in short order. And then we come into the current year findings, and if there are things that we identify, we'll bring those to your attention. And I'm going to touch upon those in a minute here, particularly why there's some in a particular area, the IT area. But what's important to remember is that this is not a situation where we come in and we go, gotcha, type thing. This is a collaborative effort. We bring these to the attention of management, discuss them thoroughly. We want to make sure we got it right. Do we fully understand the issue? And then, you know, we want an opportunity to explain, okay, here's what we found, here's a suggestion or recommendation for improvement, and then we want your staff to evaluate it and make a determination and include it in the report in regards to their concurrence and or what will be done to correct it or move the issue forward. So I think it's important to notice that. The other thing is that, you know, our profession and our firm in particular is really cognizant of the ongoing and ever-evolving and sophistication of information technology and within your organization. And so our firm has come a long way in a very long period of time, but even more recently, we've got some very, very competent people that came out and looked at IT controls. And that's why you'll see some of those comments in there, kind of focusing on IT. That's not to say that we didn't look at these things in the past, but they just continue as we get smarter and as your systems get more sophisticated, we want to focus that effort on that. So with that, go ahead.
Andy, could you also comment on that? Because I know that it had been a few years, maybe 3 years, since there had been someone to come in and really take a look at the IT area. I think it's also one of the reasons why there's some additional areas that weren't showing last year.
Right.
So it's been a few years.
So yeah. we do this on a rotational basis, whether it's, you know, the previous engagement or the previous emphasis didn't result in any significant findings, and over time, the controls, the systems, the personnel didn't change significantly, and so we may just follow up on our previous questionnaires and just say, has anything changed? If nothing's changed and we can corroborate that, then we really don't spend much more time on it other than that. But on a rotational basis, we can't just continue to say that in perpetuity, because then that's a false positive, if you will, in my opinion. And so we just felt that it was time, number one. We had a transitional team at the top, if you will, from our organization, and we just thought it was a good time to look at things, and we did. As I said, the controls are fantastic, no impact on the financial statements, but if there's things that we can see that you need to shore up or improve upon, we'll bring those to your attention.
Andy, thank you. I'd like to follow up with saying, yeah, I agree with everything you say. I'm glad you do what you do. I'm glad you present the deficiencies that are in the system, because then we have the opportunity to correct that. So I have no problem with how you do it or what you do and what you've explained to us. But I do have some questions that I would like answered. This first is the last year, the Life Status 360 services, you reported to us how many letters we sent out for the over 90 group. I couldn't remember that figure, and that figure I wanted to just, can you give me a ballpark figure as to how many letters we sent out for the over 90 group?
Yeah, so it wasn't just over 90 that we were, there were some different age categories depending on where they resided
okay.
and such. Off the top of my head,
was it 300, 400, or
could be that many?
I remember it was somewhere around 300 to 400, but I'm not sure. It might have been a little bit more. Okay, but that's a question I have. I'm curious
that
about
was at
that.
At the end of last year.
And when we do the CPAS, I have some questions on that I'll go into later. But again, that was part of one of your recommendations a year ago, and I know that this organization has been trying to correct that. Okay, back to the original current year agreement upon conditions and recommendations. The very first item, incorrect contribution data in participating accounts. You found that you tested 15 current year lump sum distribution testing. We noted 3 of the 15 transitions still show the contribution balance in the CPAS account. So actually that's around 20%. What happens with that money, and does it eventually get to the person?
Yeah, so in this case, it was cleared out of the subledger system, which is where that data, because one of the issues was indicated about, oh, the actuary might receive incorrect data, that kind of thing. They didn't in this case, because it was actually in the subledger system that data was pulled and given to the actuary. Some info gets pulled from subledger, some info gets pulled from CPAS. And so the actuary would have received the correct data in that case, because it had been cleared out of subledger.
Okay, well, it said
some that still
later on in that paragraph, it says not removing contribution balances from CPAS can lead to incorrect data being transmitted to the actuary, thus causing the actuarial reports and assumptions to be incorrect. But you're saying you've made those corrections?
Yeah, so what I'm saying is that the data that we're talking about came from subledger, which those items had been cleared out of.
Okay.
So we didn't have that issue of it getting not, you know,
okay.
incorrectly reported.
Could okay. doesn't mean did, in this case, jury.
Correct. Yeah, okay. yeah. That's an important
As we again, what did you say?
Well, could, I think the description is it could lead to the sending of
yes.
the actuary.
Yes.
Didn't mean in this case.
Well,
did.
And again, glad for bringing it up. Let's check
Absolutely.
It out.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
and so to the point. Okay. There was.
Terry, can I make a quick comment
sure.
on that? Though? As part of the audit process, I know that this might not be the not so good, but as a county manager, I relish on this part, because this is a constructive feedback that as an organization, we learn from.
Exactly.
And so the term is called agreed upon conditions because it does two things. It gives the auditors an awareness. Do we have a good understanding of what's going on in your organization? Just as Gail pointed out, the CPAS system might have a balance, but that's not what was used to clear it out.
This year, right?
We, you know, for better or for worse, we have dependency on two systems, and we're migrating to go to one system. That'll be another conversation that we have. But we sit down and we speak with the auditors about this, and I speak with the departments. Is this an accurate description? Do we have it right? And through that exchange, we learn about, hey, this is where we need to improve on. So, yes, we're into the opinion, but the agreed upon conditions is where we learn about how to improve operationally. So I just wanted to interject on that each and every one of these, it was a discussion with all the departments and team members to put through.
I agree. And in going through them, none of them seemed to be a major issue that would call us to be in trouble with any other, like IRS or anybody else. So, you know, I understand that. But there's still points here.
Absolutely.
And I think
absolutely
we as trustees need to, if we have a question about it, need to express it and figure out what's
absolutely, absolutely. Right. And they should be in front of you, and they should be, and you should be entitled to what are we doing about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. While I go through this, if somebody else has something, because there's a couple other questions I may have, but I've got to reread it.
Did you want to present these, or are you just going to open them up to questions?
Yeah, why don't we take a moment while you're reviewing your notes?
Yeah, yeah.
For them walk through.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we were going to do this thing, not other things, but
our normal process is not to review each and every.
Okay,
one,
all right.
But address any questions. But we'd certainly be happy to do that. If that was a pleasure.
Okay.
Why don't you just continue your presentation and then.
And maybe touch and just take 30 seconds to touch on kind of what was just mentioned there, that these aren't items that, you know, rise to materiality level, that rise to something, okay, you know, that what are really the agreed upon conditions.
Well, that's what I tried to preface my comments on, is that these are things that, you know, I guess I don't lose sleep over, for lack of a better term, because there was no impact on the financial reporting process and your financial statements, and that, you know, that's the number one important aspect of the engagement. But with that said, we can't just stick our head in the sand and say, hey, we saw a couple of these things, but they didn't have any impact, don't worry about it. What we're trying to prevent here is any of these types of items or issues that could result from these items rising to that higher level and ultimately becoming a significant problem and meet the criteria for a significant deficiency or a material weakness or a misstatement in your financial statements. And that's really the spirit of these and the context in which they are presented. I'm not saying they're not important, they are. They wouldn't be in this report. We would not have spent the effort and the time and your time, you know, coming up with responses and addressing these things. But that's kind of the context that I wanted to.
Andy, way back in my distant past, materiality was a 5% number. No doubt it's gotten far more sophisticated in recent times. Could you talk a little about how you determine whether something is material?
Absolutely.
There's an SOC.
And that's as old as the profession is. That debate and discussion is one of the first things you learn in auditing 101 is what's material. And as affectionately known as bean counters, we love to be able to quantify things. Makes us very comfortable. And so the process is still a quantification process. When I started, it was the 5 or 10% of assets or total revenues. And that was kind of your yardstick, and it's evolved considerably since then. It's through just a matrix, if you will, of dollar amounts that exist in some software that we use. We plug some numbers in and out pops our materiality number. It's something that we can hang our hats on, that we use as a guide, if you will, in the audit process in determining whether or not something is material. But the quantification is only one aspect of it. If it's a dollar and it means something different to somebody else, or if somebody outside the organization is placing reliance on that $1 being absolutely accurate, then we have to ignore, for lack of a better term, the quantification and go into the qualification, or, you know, how important is this number. And so materiality means different things to different people, but we quantify it and then take into consideration, particularly these types of items, did anything that we found result in your financial statements being misstated, whether it's pursuant to an exact dollar amount, or, you know, sometimes we find a number of misstatements or errors or misestimations, those kind of things, and so we can't just ignore them individually. We have to aggregate them and again determine whether or not that materiality threshold has been met. But that's really an art, and, you know, I mean, they have classes on what materiality is, 8 hours, believe it or not, on the definition of materiality. But it's changed a little bit, but not much. The debate still continues. What's materiality here?
And I did want to mention also that at the quarterly audit committee meetings, we do provide progress updates on, you know, the recommendations that are shown here, and that we are working towards full implementation of those. So, you know, in the following year, we're not in a place where it's like, oh yeah, that didn't get done last year. What happened to that? You know? So that there is that feedback.
Well, that's really the best process. Like I say, we come back in a year and we look these over, but we're not just trying to say, okay, did you cross a T or dot an I here? It was, did you keep the board informed? Did you let them know
what
you were doing? Set up a matrix? Did you address the issue? Because nobody, and I know your management in particular, likes to have repeat findings. And so that's the spirit under which we take them. So they're not going to just, you know, get forgotten about after today. Because if they are, then that's going to be one of our first findings, is we had all these findings, you guys did nothing about it. And that's that tone at the top that we
talked really about. If you look at management responses for the current year findings, you could see that even once we notified them of issues we were seeing, they've already started to implement stuff. Almost all their responses say in the process, so it's already begun. They're really reactive that way. So,
Jerry?
Yeah, I've got one more. Agreed upon condition 3, incorrect 129 employer data. Granted, it was only one employer, but can you tell me first how you came about it? And I understand that we've contacted that employer and we've made changes in it, and it's okay now. But how did you come across it?
So when we select our active population, we also send a confirmation to the individual active members. We send confirmations to the actuary and then to the employer. And the employer one is mainly concerned with, what do they consider pensionable salary? What are they providing to the retirement? How is the retirement classifying that in their system? It's my understanding.
So you also contact the employer?
Yes.
Yeah.
So this came up in that test. And what happened was, is when we were looking at your system, there was a difference between what we were pulling out as pensionable salary in comparison to what we were provided, which was not necessarily what Contra Costa receives on a monthly basis. So therein lied the problem. I think it was discovered that whatever the employer was providing Contra Costa was incorrect.
Out of curiosity, was it a larger or a smaller employer?
It'll be smaller, usually.
Oh, okay.
I believe it was smaller.
Thank you. Good.
And this is not unique to your system, unfortunately.
Pardon me?
This is not unique to your system.
No, I doubt not. Probably to others either.
But this is a test that we've only had around for about 3 to 4 years. And it's really important just to look at how people are classifying, you know, and what is the pensionable salary going to be later on.
Final average salaries mean a lot.
Yep. So we never catch anything like alarming, like large. It's usually we get this huge list of classification of different payroll amounts, and we sit there and we compare every line item to what they're classifying. And it's usually something small that's going to be discovered.
That's mostly what I was concerned. Thank you.
But here I believe it wasn't an issue, and the difference in classification, it was just the transmittal you folks were getting on a monthly basis. Correct.
Eric?
A couple of thoughts or questions, if I could. On that same condition, the recommendation is that we try and get access to some of the district payroll systems, and management's response, I think, is understandably soft. What do you think the prospects are going to be for us to be able to do this? It's going to be employer by employer. How cooperative are they going to be? Is it going to take a year or so to work everybody out, and or is this relatively straightforward? Because a lot is on the employer.
Raleigh has his hand up.
Well, Raleigh's excited in the
room. I'm sorry.
Oh, Raleigh's, is he waving his hands back there?
We'll put your name in the hat for random, too.
This actually is an item that we cover in the employer audit process, and under the board regs, one of the reporting standards is to provide demographic information, and there's a format in what's required of the employer to transmit to us. In the previous employer audit reports, we've actually discussed this with the audit committee, that we've had some observations related to this when we go through our sample and looked at active employees, you know, position change, salary action, a leave of absence, something like that needs to be communicated on the I-29. That's really important because that gets fed into our pension administration system, Collins Department of Member Services. That's what they do all the data extracts, do our reporting to the actuary, to the auditor. So it is part of our audit process to go through and look at this point.
I understand that, but this sounds a little broader. This sounds as if there would be an expectation on a regular basis outside of the formal audit process that we would be able to sample this data from employers.
Well, when there's a change with the employee, they are to record that on the I-29 and transmit that to us. If there's a termination, if there's a change in their salary, a job action where they've moved to another position, a position change, these are all in the demographic requirements of the I-29.
Okay.
And I think one of the keywords on this one is samples. You know, I think that it's one thing if we're asking, oh, employers, give us your, give us your entire database on this.
Right.
You know, when it talks about samples, you know, it's a little bit, you know, easier to provide something like that.
Okay. Anybody else on 4? I had some thoughts on 5, but I don't want to get
I'm
ahead
done.
Of the rest of the group. 5 has to do with, it focuses on a relatively small but important part of the termination process, and it focuses on termination. I'm wondering whether or not, and I know this wasn't covered by the audit, but it begs the question as to whether or not we have robust enough procedures for not only termination but broader separation, because not everyone who leaves the organization has been terminated. And do we have a process that cancels passwords, that cancels card keys, collects regular keys? Unfortunately, these things do happen sometimes where people leave the organization, not this one necessarily, but lots of organizations, where they have lots of access to things. And it sounds like this might be, you're focused on one part, which is the card key or the passwords.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like it could be a little broader and could be included in a separation package as opposed to simply termination. This focuses on actions taken by the organization to separate themselves as opposed to someone who just leaves routinely.
I think it's a generic term.
Yes.
It doesn't mean involuntary termination. It means anyone who is no longer working here.
Yeah. Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, it still focuses on just the one password, the IT part. There's some other things that could be incorporated
right.
in that.
Right.
Okay.
And we are currently, actively getting key fob, if we're not getting key fob back, we're turning it off, all of those things are being done. I do think that, when it comes to employees that leave Sisera, that we should have a documented process of, okay, and then even for certain, one thing I've been mulling over is also in certain positions so that we ensure that, everyone, because certain individuals have a lot of access to certain things and, making sure that, we're getting 10 out of 10 and not 9 out of 10 closed
right.
out.
It's a separate termination checklist. Did we get this? This? Was this done? Was this done? Was this done? Was this done?
Yeah, that's a really good point because we really just, as you said, tunnel vision. We were focused on the passwords for IT access. This is really almost even an HR function, if you will. If there is someone terminated or leaving the organization, I agree. We got the fob back. We activated whatever access they have to things outside of this, just the IT system. So it's a really good point. If I could mention
from the HR side, we do have a separation checklist that we go through with anybody in the organization, which includes all of those things. So that's how we know what they have, what to get back. Exit interview, all of that is on there.
Okay. His finding did come out of the IT audit, and as you know, the technology in IT is changing, cybersecurity being controlled. You know, there's other discussion about passwords. So also the size of the firm, the organization, are you small? Or do your systems connect with each other? And right now, Cicera has standalone systems, and so we have to think about the security on all that. And so I appreciate this one because it came out of the IT review about what are we doing. Sometimes we get caught up in reconciliations and financial records and we lose sight about simple things like access. You know, there's another one about passwords, the length of passwords. You know, we're making those more robust and it can be easily be done. So we've already started on all that process, but
I've seen too many instances and saw someone personally in the organization where you put in all these procedures, you put in lots of robust systematic procedures which are quickly ignored by some employees.
They will make
their password. Yeah. You know, and if they want to be really clever, they'll call it password 123. And you know, then they share passwords. My workstation's on, go ahead and use mine. Mm-hmm. Which totally defeats what you were trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for telling everybody my password.
It's the number one password used in the United States.
That's why I was laughing.
Password 123.
That's very amazing clever to me.
What do you normally use for a password?
Never mind.
It's a capital P. You got to have a capital P and a symbol at the end. Yeah, that'll differentiate it.
I forgot to ask. Yeah, I don't know. It's too specific. But do the screens time out after a period of? In the system, how long roughly is it? Is it 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
They do. I don't know what the automatic setting that we have is.
At like 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
Yeah,
that's pretty generous. Different subject, but that's generous.
Because we have some system that the user requests they don't want to lock, like some imaging system, and we can tie it out by department too.
And also, too, if someone is on a phone with a member and they're working on something, they don't want to be, like, timing out of the screen that they're, helping that member on as well.
One of the topics that comes up with termination is exit interviews. Is that something we do, and are those exit interviews something you look at?
That's what
you have. We do exit interviews.
HR.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that the audit looks at.
No.
Yeah,
Any other?
But we do make use of them. Yeah.
Any other trustee questions for our auditors, for Henry?
Thank you. It's a good report too.
That does conclude our presentation. But I would be remiss if I didn't thank the very competent staff for their accommodations, their attention to detail, working with us. Without them, we could not provide these deliverables to you. So we really thank everybody here at the organization for everything they do to help us, and we just really enjoy this organization and working with you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You. Have a good ride home, man.
Thank you.
If you're going to head down, now's the time to head down.
Be able to find me.
We'll take a real short break as our next guest get ready.
Thank you.
Recording excerpted.